Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Elba, Michigan, and became a world-class downhill ski racer. Following an injury, he earned a chiropractic degree from Palmer Chiropractic College and founded and ran a back pain clinic for 15 years. He then set out to change the world of seating technology. 20 years later and 20 patents later, we are all the beneficiaries of his genius. His name, Dr. Brock Walker. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. Brock Walker, who's changed the seating technology for the world. Dr. Walker, a real honor to have you.
Well, thanks for having me, Jack. This has been a lot of fun meeting you and your entire team. And you've been a great motivator getting me to remember names.
That's an inside joke.
Yes.
All right. Hopefully, I'll remember your mom and dad's names.
I will. Okay. I'll go for it.
Talk about your mom and your dad and your childhood.
Well, we grew up in on a farm in northern Michigan. It was a crop farm. We had a long heritage of clearing the land, and a little farming took place with my grandfather beforehand, and he handed the farm down to my father. And we lived there from the time I was born until I went off to college in 1971.
What's the biggest thing, Brock, you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
Well, I think the biggest thing I learned from my dad was that farmers have an intuitive idea and an acceptance of how Mother Nature works. If you really think about it, farmers are unique in the fact that they see the cycle of life every day. They see things come and they see things go. They see things born. They see things that die away. And they have a perspective on life that's pretty darn unique. And I think that has helped me throughout my entire existence whenever I met any kind of adversity. You have to put it all in perspective. And from my mother, I just learned that the most important thing is to tell the truth. You gotta tell the truth if you want to free yourself up to go wherever it is that the winds are going to take you.
Where did you get your love for downhill skiing?
Well, my dad grew up originally in northern Michigan, in the Marquette area, and of course they were big skiers. And so in a town of 350 people, 7 miles from Boyne Mountain, there wasn't a lot else to do. So the entire family took up skiing. I had a younger sister and an older brother, and all of us took up skiing as a family. And that kind of morphed into a competitive atmosphere, and that really ignited and opened our minds to that there is another universe out there with the travel and so on and so forth of going to different ski events around the world.
Doctor, you love sports to this day. What do you think when you watch the Winter X Games today?
Well, it's not the same event. I mean, we really have an aerobatic event going on. And when I grew up, it was alpine skiing and Nordic skiing. Guys jumped off, big jumps, and people went down through slalom courses. And today, the big events aren't really related to that as much as those events still remain. And in Europe, it's quite a big event still. But in the U.S., I think we've gone more to the acrobatics and the excitement of human performance.
Tell us about your ski racing days,
well,
and be honest.
Well, I was good when I was young, and for some reason, the older I got, the worse I got. But I spent the early days training. There wasn't a lot else to do on the farm, so I concentrated on it. I had a passion for it. I think my biggest goal was to try to to make it onto a junior national team. Everybody's got to have a goal. That was mine. And by the end of my career, I'd qualified for the junior national team 7 times, which was a new record, I'm sure. And then I went on to college and World Cup, FIS, European Cup, and so on and so forth, and 4 years in the World Pro Tour, at which time I decided that I wanted to, do something else with my life. And that's when I decided to get involved in physical medicine.
What was the highlight of your racing days?
Oh, I think the travel, the ability that to see outside of Michigan. I mean, really, where I grew up, there wasn't a lot of travel, and it was a unique situation for me to go out and see the world, and of course be introduced to people that would really broaden your horizons in terms of possibilities. Places you could go with your talent. And it wasn't all as intimidating when it was all over. Whereas if I would have stayed in a small farming community, I think that would have been closed in quite a bit.
You mentioned that chapter of your life ends, that glorious chapter, ski racing, and then you decide to become a chiropractor. Why?
Well, I liked the physical medicine side of it. I wanted to be a doctor, but, really the doctor thing went out of my... kind of expanded beyond my envelope of what I really wanted to do. I really wanted to focus on the human performance side of physical medicine. And I looked at medicine, and I looked at osteopathy, and I looked at chiropractic. And in the end, the chiropractic move was the right move for me. I concentrated totally on physical medicine, and then when it became time to really integrate myself into the medical community, I built some really nice inroads with medical physicians of all types and osteopathy and other forms of physical therapy and so on and so forth. And so it really ended up where we had a multi-interdisciplinary approach to treating patients. And so in the end, I think it was the right move.
Some people, many people, believe that chiropractors are voodoo doctors.
Yeah, I was told that more than once. Well, I was told that more than once, but I think it's all in keeping it in perspective. I'm a big believer that once you have your education, that's just the beginning. The second part of the avenue is that you have to take what you've learned and create something out of it. And in my case, I understood the human body, and I understood a little bit about business, and I understood that it was a team of people that were really going to produce the results, not one person. So I surrounded myself with all different kinds of physicians.
We're talking to Dr. Brock Walker, and he was introduced to a man named Buddy Lazier that not only changed Brock's life, but changed all of our lives. And I'm Jack Masula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Masula, and we're with Dr. Brock Walker, who one day met a man named Buddy Lazier. And the rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history. This really turned a lot of research around. Most people really focus on the highlights of what happened. And the long and the short of it was that Buddy had an accident in an Indianapolis race car 2-3 months before the Indianapolis 500. This would have been in 1996. And Buddy was in really rough shape. To put it mildly, he couldn't really stand, sit, or lay down. He couldn't take pain medications because he wouldn't be able to drive the car. And there was really no way for him to fit inside the Indianapolis race car. Certainly, there's no way for him to sit inside the Indianapolis race car and drive 500 miles. But his father, who was also a former Indianapolis 500 driver, asked me if there was any way that we thought that we could create a cockpit for him that would be comfortable and secure enough for him to drive in the 1996 Indy 500. And, of course, I thought Bob Lazier was his buddy's father's name. I thought Bob had lost his mind. But I will tell you, they're persistent people, and racing people are a tough crowd. So I did go to Indianapolis a little earlier that year, and I worked with Buddy, and we built a cockpit design that utilized some of the hypotheses that I had been working on with seating. Long story short, he fit into the cockpit. He took a little nap, which I thought was a good sign. His body was really acclimating itself well to the environment. And at that point, he had run three or four laps, I believe. I might be wrong on that, but I think that's about all he did. Once we had the seat finished, I left and went to another racetrack around the world. On race day, my son came running up to me and said, "Dad, you got to get in the motor coach and turn on the TV set. Buddy Lazier is going to win the Indianapolis 500. Well, Buddy Lazier did, and it turned the entire world of seating upside down, and it started to bring to the forefront that maybe some of the things that we had been working so hard on over the years that went against the normal grain of ergonomics and seating design were coming into their own. And it was really a launching pad for a whole new way of thinking about seating and the importance of how you might design and develop and create a seat for people that sit in numbers of different environments, not just a race car.
20 patents later, 20 inventions later,
yeah,
you've revolutionized seating. And it's changed the life of hundreds of thousands or millions of people every day. Talk to us, Dr. Walker, about the miracle we call the human back.
Yeah, this is a great subject because, you know, a lot of my friends ask me from time to time, well, isn't working in seating a little boring? And even salespeople that are selling many of the most high technical chairs that are made today get a little relaxed, and maybe it does get a little boring. And here's how I respond to that to try to create some motivation. 85% of all the people on the planet to go to work today, they're going to sit down when they get there. In the United States, we know that 71% of the people are going to sit at least 8 hours a day. 21% are going to sit 12 hours a day. And there's a lot more sitting going on than that, you know. You're going to get to work. You're going to go home. You're bushed. You're going to sit on the sofa. So the sitting thing is a big deal. To correspond with that, in the United States alone, we have 91 million acute back pain patients, or sufferers, I should say, every day. And to put that into context and why this seating thing is such an important issue and why it isn't so boring is if you look at the statistics, the number one reason that people miss work is back pain. The number one reason that people file for disability under the age of 45 is back pain. And over the next two decades, we're going to have 80 million baby boomers filing for permanent disability because of back pain. And there's this common thread that runs from back pain to sedentary lifestyle. And I think that's what the technology of today and tomorrow is trying to achieve. We're trying to get that under control and provide a prevention versus a treatment.
Tell us about your 12-year partnership with the Herman Miller Company.
Yeah, this was terrific. You know, it's terrific in so many different ways, but in reality, it gave me a team of people to play with, and a team of people that had an open mind, and a team of people that knew that they wanted to do the same things that I wanted to do. In reality, I reverse that and say I wanted to do the same things they wanted to do, and it's been a terrific relationship. We are on the forefront of providing a series of new technologies every year. Every year that opens up, we've created something new. Their engineers are phenomenal. And I, you know, I've worked in a lot of different industries. I've worked in everything from automotive to aerospace to military, defense, you name it. Anything where a person can go from a standing to a sitting position and be affected by its environment. But by far away, I believe that my relationship with Herman Miller is productive because of their designers, their engineers, and their leadership, which allows us to play and create technologies that will go out there and really affect hundreds of millions of people over the next decade.
You helped Herman Miller come up with the Aeron, A-E-R-O-N, chair, which has taken over the high-end chair business. What's so special about the Aeron chair?
Well, a little bit of a change there. That the Aeron chair was the most, I would consider it to be the most comfortable office chair, developed in the late 80s. And it reached a point where I was introduced to Herman Miller, and we decided that maybe we could even improve upon that. And we thought that maybe we could test a new technology. And that new technology is called posture fit. And it supports the human body below the belt line where it's needed most, versus higher in the lumbar region, which most of you are familiar with. And this posture fit technology was integrated into their Aeron chair. And the Aeron chair is really an iconic office chair design. It's many people would recognize it because it's mesh and it's not foam. It was the first of its kind. And it resides on permanent display in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City.
Doctor, what's the difference between the office chair circa 1980 and the office chair of today?
I think we've learned how to control the human body in any postural position, in any environment, and how to manage it, and how to create it, how to help it create its strength, how to create its horsepower from a standing to a sitting position. And I think primarily in the 80s, we were capturing some of that, but now we have a real method and a process and a system that draws a common thread through our product development strategy, the technology, material science, medicine, engineering, and design. So we're capturing more of the body. We're moving more of the body around than we could in the 1980s.
A lot of us have more bodies to move around
than
the 1980s.
True. That's true.
Speaking of which, one of the best ways not to get back pain is to keep strong stomach muscles. Why is it so important to keep the stomach muscles strong?
Well, it's the core of the body. If you take a look at the body, you have a series of large muscles in the torso and the upper body, and you have a large group of muscles in the lower extremities, but they all anchor in the pelvic area, in the abdominal area. And in order for your body to create horsepower and to create its own strength, that lower body and upper body have to talk to each other, and they primarily do it through the abdominal muscles.
We're talking to Dr. Brock Walker, and we'll come back. We're going to ask him about his son, Ryan. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Brock Walker, who, his wife, Debbie, and him are blessed to have Ryan. Ryan becomes a world-class race car driver. How?
Well, for years, Ryan would sit on the steps of the IndyCar in the paddock and on the steps of the trucks of some of the most famous race car drivers in the world. And at the time, he was 5, 6, 7 years old, and he would watch mechanics work, and he was just part of the crowd. And so he grew up around it, around the sport. And, you know, most of the IndyCar drivers, when they do have children, they somehow like to keep them involved in the sport. And so the kids start out, and they start in go-karts, not the kind of go-karts we had when we were kids, but high-performance go-karts, and some of them reaching speeds up to nearly 100 miles an hour. So I was always against this whole process, and I said, boys, stay away from me on this issue. I don't want anything to do with this. But one day I kind of broke, and I said, all right, listen, we're going to get a used cart. We're going to put in the back of the Jeep. We're going to go to the local track. But that's it, and I mean it. Well, fast forward about 3 years, and we had a sizable trailer and visiting every major racetrack in the United States. And that's really how we got his start. And shortly thereafter, when he was 15, we decided that it was too dangerous, and we came up with the idea that, okay, I know what we'll do. We'll get him in a car because it's got a roof over the top of it. And hey, what's the chances of him being any good anyway? That was the launch of Ryan Walker's racing career.
Tell us about his racing career.
Yeah, his racing career was pretty unique. I can remember, in fact, I still have a photo of him in Canada in a Formula Ford and a Formula 2000 car, where he was actually sitting in the car reading a manual. Because you have to remember, he was only 15. And he didn't have a prior background in a car. Most of the kids didn't start in a car until they got much older. So Ryan progressed real quickly in the Canadian series, and he came to the U.S. and raced in the Canadian series, or in the U.S. series. And then shortly thereafter, I was working in North Carolina on some projects, and Ryan came down to North Carolina and was going to transfer from open-wheel cars to a NASCAR. And some things developed in Europe that allowed him to go to Europe at the age of, I guess he was probably 18 at the time, and drive a Formula 3 car, which turned out to be a very exciting part of our entire family's life. And he did extremely well in Europe, finished third in the Formula 1 British Series, came home to visit, and that's kind of where things got off the track, so to speak.
He comes back to Lansing to just visit you and Debbie. And on June 26, 2001, the two of you get a phone call. There's been an accident, and your son has died.
Well, the person on the phone, I was sitting in my office, and I remember it vividly. A lady who I'd never met, and I never have met, called me on the phone, and she was in hysteria. And she said, do you know Ryan Walker? Do you know Ryan Walker? And I kept saying, yes, he's my son. And she said, well, he's dead. And, well, you can imagine what goes through every parent's mind at that point. So you actually live through that process. But by the time we got to the hospital, he was standing up. He was talking to doctors. And I remember vividly having this. You can't explain the emotional trauma. But I remember the doctor saying, we can't let him lie down. He's had a terrible hematoma deep in the brain. And Ryan turned around, and I remember he said to us, Mom, Dad, hey, what are you doing here? And he was happy to see us. And we were so relieved. He turned back around to talk to the doctors, and then turned back around to talk to us and said, Mom, Dad, what are you doing here? And then we knew we had some real problems. But the good news is he's with us today. We are working very hard and have learned a great deal about closed head injury. And we're just ecstatic that we've been able to weather the storm. You learn so much along the way that, you know, it makes you grow up, no matter what age you are.
What was the actual accident?
Well, the accident was at a stoplight where a fella came off the expressway at a rapid rate of speed. He hit him so hard in the passenger side of his Explorer that it literally can-opened his Explorer. And so it was a passenger car that actually ended his racing career. But he always said to me, he said, you know, I'm not afraid in a race car. You can be going to football field a second. That's damn fast, excuse me, but it is. It's very fast. A lot of things can happen. And he never felt like it was a dangerous situation, but he always said, you know, we have 15-year-old kids that have never driven a lawnmower. They're in a top-heavy SUV. They have absolutely no idea what can happen at 20 miles an hour.
You've led a, up until this June 26, 2001, Doc, you've led a fairy tale life. And then, out of nowhere, the storm comes. What did you say to God?
Well, I did a lot of, asking. I just tried to open myself up to receive the instructions. I knew that I wasn't able to handle it the way that you can't make sense out of something like this. And you're so out of sorts, you're so out of balance that you really need to concentrate spiritually beyond what anything is or any goal you've ever set for yourself. And if you do that, you start to hear messages coming back the other way. You know, it's that old saying, quit doing all the talking and do more listening. And that's one thing that whole entire event did for our entire family. It taught us to listen. It taught us to be patient. Oh, it taught us to be humble. It taught us to be grateful. It taught us things, not that we weren't prior to that, but this is a new level of experiencing it.
In these last 12 and a half years, what has Ryan taught you and Debbie?
Well, patience. You know, I mean, that's the big word. You know, it's just patience. It's like, I think as parents, we all go through this. I just have to think this is a different level of play, though. You really have to concentrate on trying to focus on issues and trying to focus on keeping it out in the open and family dialogue.
We're talking to Brock Walker, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're with Dr. Brock Walker, who's revolutionized seating technology in the world. Doc, talk to us about willing something to happen in our life.
It's easy. It just sounds hard. You know, it's what we all struggle with. But you know what? You really can live your dreams. And if I was going to give young people any advice whatsoever, I'd say the number one priority that you have to get straight beyond your spiritual relationship is your self-reliance. Become self-reliant on yourself, understanding that you're going to need a team of people around you to be successful. But let your mind roll. Let it go out there naturally and realize that God gave you this body. He wrapped air around your head, food up out of the ground. It's going to be okay. He's not going to leave you in the dust. All you have to do is listen to what's happening in your own heart. That's the main thing. And you will be able to eventually achieve your goals. Self-discipline is a really tough thing in today's society, but that's what it takes. But if you can become self-disciplined, you can become self-reliant, and you can team with other peoples to create an innovation or make your dream come through, something that has value, you're going to live a life that very few people have the ability to they might have the ability to live it, but they certainly don't take the gumption and the focus to follow through with it. And I guess it's just follow through, Jack.
Speaking of very few people living the way you live, that's your life. 20 patents later, 20 inventions later, what's next? What are your goals? What are your dreams?
More things that help people live better lives. That's where I try to put my focus. You know, we talk about seating a lot, but seating's just a place. It's just an environment for me to be able to play and do my work. Everything that I do in seating is really comes under the heading of healthcare and medicine. It's the only place in your environment where you have a human interface between man and his machine or his work, so to speak. So being able to help the human body do what it does better, easier, with a lot of endurance over a longer period of time is going to only help people achieve what they need to achieve in less pain than they're achieving it now.
Most inventors, when we think of an inventor, we think of the absent-minded professor. You're a quintessential inventor, and at the same time, you're very personable, and you got a very disarming sense of humor. They don't usually go together.
Well, it's pretty funny because when you think about it, people ask me, well, what do you do for a living? And I start to think about that over the years, and I think, well, I don't know how I inherited this. But on the left side of the page is this medically engineered technology of mine, and it's about science and medicine. And on the right side of the page is designers that I work with. And they have a totally different and a very complex view of life sometimes. Yet we've got to take what's in their mind and in their dreams, and we've got to create something that's going to have value to people. And in order to do that, you have to have material scientists and you have to have engineers. And bringing all these worlds together to create an innovation of value is kind of what I've inherited in my work life. And it's been extremely rewarding because we all have a sense of being good at something, but being able to really experience and watch other people do what they do well and bring it all together to create something is really a wonderful after. It's almost like an afterthought. It's like it just pops out at the end and you're like, wow, this is fantastic. What a way to live.
Today starts Holy Week, Palm Sunday, and you see things from a different set of eyes than most of us. What's the most amazing thing about God from Brock Walker's eyes?
It's really that he has given you everything you need. I can explain it this way. A lady once told me that no two people have ever been put on this planet to have the same experience. And I think about that every day. Because you wonder why it seems other people have better lives and some have more challenging lives. But, you know in your own heart, somehow, some way, if you just listen to yourself, that things do work together. As much as we don't understand them, they work together for the good of what Christ has brought to earth and what God has created.
Success is a journey, not a destination. And for an inventor, you're trying. Edison tried, I think, 2,500 times before he was successful with the light bulb. Talk to us about success being a journey, not a destination.
Well, there's one other saying that I don't know if I'm going to get it right, but I'll give you the big idea. It's that man can accomplish anything if he just doesn't care who gets the credit. And that was a famous thing that Ronald Reagan always had on his desk. When I visited his museum, the gal that was there and gave us a look into some different parts of the museum made a big point out of that because she knew him well. And she said, that's what drove him in so many successful directions. It's the team. It really doesn't come down to what you accomplish because you can't do it alone. It comes down to the team of people that you have around you and the attitude that you want everyone to be happy and successful. And that just creates more and more positive ramifications as projects and days and years, go forward.
When we were getting together today, and I said, boy, this is a beautiful day, you said, Jack, I woke up today and I was ready to invent.
Yeah.
It was just one of those days I was ready to invent. Talk about those special days.
Yeah, well, I think invention is a lot like writing. I think you probably can have days where you have blocks, where you just, boy, nothing comes out. And when those days happen, you've got to be productive doing something else. You've got to keep your mind really rolling in the right direction. If you can't create, then you need to set up an environment and improve your environment around you, that when the creation jag hits you, you're ready to roll. You know, that's so important, because it can hit you in the middle of the night and you got to get up. You should not stay in bed. Get up, grab your pad and pencil, and go out in the other room and just start writing and let it flow. And then in the morning when you wake up and you read it, it's like half of it's garble, but you might pick up like one or two things and you're like, wow, that's a great idea, you know? And so the invention thing's kind of, it's an artistic thing, but when you don't have it flowing, stay engaged with the people and stay engaged with the event.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Self-discipline, man. Self-discipline. Don't rely on other people to craft your life. Listen to yourself. No matter how difficult, how tough you think you've got it, somebody's always got it tougher. And you just have to dig in. You have to set your goals. You have to focus. And you have to say to yourself, I'm not gonna let this thing go sideways. I'm going to accomplish this. It's possible that, you know, you hear people say, well, I'm not sure how my life will turn out. But you know what you hardly ever hear people say? Hey, I think my life's going to turn out a lot better than I can even imagine. But if you hold on to that attitude, it will take you where you need to go.
You live that every day, Dr. Brock Walker. Keep up the great, great work. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great Holy Week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoke. Believe it.